A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, continuing his series on first aid protocols, and this time, it's drowning. He spent years as a pool lifeguard, which means he's got enough baseline knowledge to know what he doesn't know anymore. The core question is, what do modern guidelines say about intervention in different circumstances? And woven through it are three things that were drilled into him in training. That drowning is often silent, not the splashing and shouting Hollywood version. That you don't need an ocean. People drown in bathtubs, and that the rescuer's instinct to rush in can get the rescuer killed. So the real question here is, given all three of those truths, what's the right way to actually help?
That third point is the one that kills people who are just trying to do the right thing. The World Health Organization's most recent global drowning report puts the annual death toll at roughly 236,000 people worldwide. That's 640-something a day, and it's the leading cause of death globally for children aged 1 to 4. Not car accidents, not disease, drowning.
1 to 4. That's a bathtub and a moment of inattention.
And the CDC breaks this down further. For every child who dies from drowning in the United States, another 8 receive emergency care for non-fatal submersion injuries. Half of those require hospitalization or transfer for further care. The brain doesn't forgive oxygen deprivation. Permanent brain damage can occur in as little as 4 to 6 minutes without oxygen. The survival window from the moment someone's airway goes under is measured in single-digit minutes, and that's for a good outcome.
The stakes are you have minutes, and if you screw up the approach, you've added one more victim. Let's start with the quiet drowning thing, because that's the one that everyone gets wrong.
The instinctive drowning response is the technical term. It was characterized by a researcher named Francesco Pia, and what he described is essentially the body's last-ditch autonomic sequence when the airway is compromised. The person cannot call for help because the respiratory system takes priority over speech. They can't wave. The arms are extended laterally, pressing down against the water in an instinctive attempt to lift the mouth clear, which means no flailing above the head. They're vertical in the water, head tilted back, and they can only stay at the surface for 20 to 60 seconds before submersion.
20 to 60 seconds.
That's the total window where you'll see them at all. And the whole thing can look, from a distance, like somebody just bobbing or treading water. A child splashing and playing can look far more dramatic than a child actively drowning 10 feet away.
Which is the cruelest part of it? The signal you're trained to look for, noise, motion, distress, is exactly what isn't there. It's the absence of those things that's the alarm.
That's why the phrase, watch your children around water, is misleading if you take it literally. Watching isn't enough if you don't know what you're watching for. The CDC is explicit, drowning is quick and quiet. It's not like what you see on television. I've heard lifeguard trainers say you should be scanning for the kid who's too quiet, not the one making noise.
The kid who's too quiet. That's a parenting rule that extends well beyond water, honestly.
Right, but around water, it's fatal. And it connects to the bathtub point. An infant can drown in 2 inches of water. The height of the water doesn't need to exceed the depth of their airway. If a toddler falls face first into a bath and can't right themselves, the water only needs to cover the mouth and nose. The mechanism is the same as an ocean drowning, airway obstruction by liquid hypoxia, cardiac arrest. The volume of water is irrelevant.
The bathtub is effectively a body of water. That reframes it.
In the home, bathtubs are the single most common site of drowning for children under 1. For children 1 to 4, it's swimming pools, but bathtubs remain a significant percentage. A 5-gallon bucket with a few inches of water in the bottom is top-heavy enough that a toddler who leans in can topple and be unable to get out.
I hadn't even considered the bucket.
Most people don't. But it's a recognized hazard in pediatric drowning literature. The common thread across all of this, pool, bathtub, bucket, lake, is that the drowning process is silent, it's fast, and the person in trouble cannot help you help them. Which brings us to the rescuer's safety question. And this is where the modern guidelines have gotten more explicit and more emphatic over the past decade.
Let's get into the sequence. Someone's in the water. They're in trouble. What's step one?
Step one is don't become victim number two. The impulse to jump in immediately is admirable, it's human, and it's frequently lethal. The WHO and every major resuscitation council now emphasize a hierarchy: reach, throw, row, go. In that order.
Reach, throw, row, go. Break that down.
Reach, if the person is close to the edge, extend something. A pole, a branch, a towel, your arm if you absolutely must, but only if you're braced and secure. The key is maintaining your own center of gravity so you don't get pulled in. A panicking drowning person will grab anything and climb it, and that includes climbing you, pushing you under in the process. Throw. Anything that floats. A life ring, a cooler, a pool noodle, an empty jug with the cap on. Aim past them so the line or object crosses their reach. Row, if there's a boat or you can get to one, use it. Go, entering the water yourself, is the last resort, and it should only be done by someone trained in water rescue who understands how to approach a panicking swimmer.
How do you approach a panicking swimmer if you're at the go stage?
You approach from behind. If they grab you, you both drown. The standard technique is to approach from the rear, reach under their armpits, and secure them with your arm across their chest, keeping their head above water while you tow them back. If they're unconscious and face down, you turn them face up while supporting the head and neck. Assume a possible spinal injury if there's any chance they dove into shallow water. The American Heart Association's current recommendation is that if you suspect a spinal injury, you immobilize the spine during the entire rescue and resuscitation sequence. That's difficult in the water, but the priority is getting them out while minimizing neck movement.
There's a tension between speed and spinal caution.
There is, and the guidelines acknowledge it. If the person isn't breathing, the need for immediate ventilation overrides perfect spinal immobilization. You get them out as carefully as you can and start resuscitation. The NHS guidelines are clear. Once the person is out of the water, check for breathing. If they're not breathing, begin CPR immediately, and with drowning, it starts with rescue breaths, not compressions.
That's a departure from standard CPR sequence.
It is, and it's one of the few condition-specific modifications. Drowning is primarily a respiratory emergency. The heart stops because the oxygen ran out, not because of a primary cardiac event. So the chain of survival starts with getting air into the lungs. 5 rescue breaths first, then 30 compressions, then 2 breaths, continuing at 30 to 2. If there's an AED available, use it. Dry the chest first so the pads stick. The Mayo Clinic emphasizes that even if the person has been submerged for a prolonged period, resuscitation should still be attempted, especially in cold water drownings, because hypothermia can be neuroprotective. There are documented cases of full neurological recovery after 60 minutes or more of submersion in icy water.
That's the cold water exception.
It's rare, but it's real enough that the guidelines say don't assume death based on submersion time alone in cold water. The rule is, no one is dead until they're warm and dead. Cold water triggers the mammalian dive reflex, bradycardia, peripheral vasoconstriction, shunting blood to the brain and heart. It's not a guarantee, but it's enough of a factor that you don't stop resuscitation until the person has been rewarmed and assessed.
To summarize the modern sequence, reach, throw, row, go, with go being a trained rescuer option. If you do go, approach from behind, mind the spine, get them out, check breathing, 5 rescue breaths, then 30 in 2. Cold water buys more time. What about after they start breathing?
That's a point a lot of people don't realize, even if someone seems fine after a near drowning. They're coughing, they're breathing, they're alert, they still need medical evaluation. There's something called secondary drowning, or more accurately, delayed drowning. It's not a formally recognized medical term, but the phenomenon it describes is real. Water aspirated into the lungs can cause pulmonary edema hours later. The surfactant in the lungs gets washed out, alveoli collapse, fluid builds up, and the person can essentially drown in their own fluids while sitting in a hospital waiting room.
That's a horror movie detail.
It's preventable by observation. The recommendation is that anyone who's had a submersion incident with loss of consciousness, or who required rescue breathing, or who has persistent coughing or difficulty breathing afterward, should be evaluated in an emergency department. Even for less severe incidents, brief submersion, no loss of consciousness, quick recovery, you watch them for several hours. If they develop coughing, chest pain, difficulty breathing, extreme fatigue, or behavioral changes, you go to the hospital immediately.
Behavioral changes is an interesting inclusion.
It's a hypoxia flag. If the brain was oxygen deprived even briefly, confusion or irritability can be a sign. Parents sometimes dismiss it as the child being tired or shaken up, but it can indicate something more serious.
The takeaway is, if there was a drowning event, even a small one, the person is not necessarily fine just because they're vertical and talking. The clock is still running.
And this is where the public health messaging has really shifted. It used to be, learn to swim, don't run near the pool, wear a life jacket. Those are all still true, but the modern approach is layers of protection. The CDC talks about it explicitly. Barriers around pools, close supervision, life jackets, swim lessons, and knowing CPR. No single layer is enough. A fence can fail, supervision lapses, a life jacket comes off. The layers cover each other's gaps.
The Swiss cheese model, but for drowning prevention.
That's exactly what it is. And the swim lessons point is worth emphasizing because there's been a shift there too. The American Academy of Pediatrics used to recommend against swim lessons for children under 4, arguing it might give parents a false sense of security. They reversed that position. The current recommendation is that children can start swim lessons as early as age 1, because the evidence shows it reduces drowning risk even at that age. Not eliminates, reduces. The false security concern is addressed by telling parents explicitly, swim lessons don't drown-proof your child. You still supervise. You still use barriers. You still learn CPR.
Which loops back to the quiet drowning point. The parent who thinks they'll hear splashing is the same parent who thinks swim lessons mean they can check their phone.
The phone is a real factor. There's a growing body of research on distracted supervision. Parents at pools and beaches who are present but not watching because they're on a device. The National Drowning Prevention Alliance has started, including Designate a Water Watcher in their campaigns, one adult whose sole job is to watch the water, phone down, for a set period, then rotate. It sounds almost insultingly basic, but the data supports it. Most drowning deaths of young children occur during a brief lapse in supervision, under 5 minutes.
Under 5 minutes. That's a single email.
That's the length of a pop song. And when you combine that with the fact that drowning doesn't announce itself, you get a scenario where a child can slip under while the parent is 30 feet away, facing them, but looking at a screen, and the parent never hears a thing.
There's something existentially bleak about that. The quietness of it. The idea that the worst moment of your life could be happening in complete silence 10 yards away while you're reading a notification.
That's why the modern training emphasizes scanning patterns, not just presence. Lifeguards are taught to actively scan in a grid, to look at the bottom of the pool, to check corners, to watch for the quiet kid. Parents at a backyard pool should be doing a version of the same thing. It's not enough to be nearby. You have to be watching, and you have to know what you're watching for.
Let's talk about the rescue a casualty thing Daniel raised, because that's the part that feels most counterintuitive. The person who jumps in to save someone and doesn't come back.
It happens with grim regularity. The CDC notes that a significant percentage of drowning deaths each year involve would-be rescuers, friends, family members, bystanders who entered the water to help and drowned themselves. It's enough that every major guideline now starts with, don't become a victim. The WHO explicitly flags it in their drowning prevention materials. The rescuer, often a parent or sibling, overestimates their swimming ability, underestimates the difficulty of rescuing a panicking person, or both.
The physics of it, a panicking adult is essentially a dead weight that's actively fighting you.
More than dead weight, they're climbing you. The instinct is to push down on anything to get higher. If you're the nearest thing, they'll push you under to lift themselves. Even a child can do this to an adult if the adult isn't trained to handle it. The technique of approaching from behind isn't just a best practice, it's a survival necessity for the rescuer.
What does the training actually look like for someone who wants to be competent at this? Not a professional lifeguard, but a parent who lives near water or has a pool.
The Red Cross and similar organizations offer water rescue courses that cover exactly this. The reach, throw, row, go hierarchy, how to approach a distressed swimmer, how to tow them, how to get them out of the water while protecting the spine, and how to start resuscitation. It's a one-day or weekend course for the basic level. I'd say for anyone with a backyard pool or who spends significant time at lakes or beaches, it's worth doing. The skills are perishable, so refreshers matter.
Perishable in what time frame?
Skills start degrading within 6 to 12 months without practice. The recommendation is annual recertification for CPR and at least a refresher on water rescue techniques every 2 years. That's for non-professionals. For lifeguards, it's more frequent.
Daniel's training from 10 plus years ago. He's right that it's outdated, not just in the details, but in the perishable skill sense.
And the guidelines have evolved. The compression-to-breath ratios changed, the emphasis on spinal precautions increased, the cold water resuscitation guidance got more aggressive, the rescue hierarchy got codified more explicitly. Even the swim lessons for infants recommendation is relatively recent. Someone who trained a decade ago and hasn't refreshed would be operating on outdated protocols.
Which is a good argument for periodic retraining, even if you never expect to use it. The moment you need it, you're not going to have time to Google current drowning CPR ratio.
That's the cognitive load problem in all first aid. Under stress, you don't rise to the occasion. You fall to your training. If your training is a decade old, you fall to a decade-old standard, and you might not even remember it clearly. The reason the rescue hierarchy is structured as a simple four-word sequence, reach, throw, row, go, is specifically to be recallable under panic. It's designed for the brain state of someone who just saw a child go under.
The mnemonic as a lifeline.
And the modern guidelines put a lot of weight on these structured decision trees. Don't think, follow the steps. Because thinking is compromised, your frontal cortex is flooded with cortisol and adrenaline. You need a script.
That's the thing about drowning rescue that's different from, say, a cut or a burn. The rescuer's own safety is in immediate mortal jeopardy the moment they enter the water. In most first aid scenarios, the rescuer isn't at risk of dying. Here they are.
That's why the go step genuinely is last resort. Even trained lifeguards are taught that a rescue that doesn't require entering the water is always preferable. If you can extend a pole, do it. If you can throw a flotation device, do it. Entering the water introduces risk to the rescuer, and a two-victim scenario is worse than a one-victim scenario.
What about drowning in non-pool settings? The bathtub, the bucket. The reach-throw-row-go framework assumes a body of water with an edge. A bathtub is different.
A bathtub drowning is typically an infant or toddler, and the rescue is essentially immediate removal from the water. There's no approach from behind dynamic, you're pulling them out directly. But the same post-rescue sequence applies. Check breathing, start CPR with rescue breaths if they're not breathing, call emergency services. And the bathtub scenario is where supervision is basically the entire prevention strategy. You don't leave a child unattended in a bath, not for 30 seconds to grab a towel, not with an older sibling watching them. You stay within arm's reach the entire time.
Arm's reach. That's the standard?
That's the standard. The American Academy of Pediatrics uses the phrase touch supervision for infants and toddlers in water. You're close enough to touch them at all times, not in the same room, not just outside the door, within arm's reach.
That's a demanding standard if you actually follow it. No phone, no doorbell, no... just 1 second.
It's demanding, and it's the only thing that works. Bathtub drownings happen in the time it takes to answer the door or check on something in the next room. The numbers are consistent on this. A lapse of under 2 minutes is all it takes. The child slips, goes under, and the silence means no one notices until it's too late.
That's the length of a toothbrushing.
If you're brushing your teeth while your toddler is in the bath, you're not within arm's reach. That's the scenario that plays out over and over.
Let's talk about beaches and open water, because the dynamics change when you add currents, waves, cold, and distance.
Open water drowning has its own risk profile. Rip currents are the big one. They account for the majority of beach rescues and a significant share of beach drownings. The typical scenario is a swimmer gets caught in a rip, panics, fights the current, exhausts themselves, and goes under. The advice that's been drilled for years is don't fight the rip, swim parallel to shore. That's still the advice, but the modern messaging adds something. If you can't swim out of it, float, signal for help. Fighting a rip current is like running on a treadmill that's going faster than you can sprint.
For the rescuer watching from shore.
Same hierarchy applies. Reach, throw, row, go. At a beach, throw might mean a rescue tube or a life ring. Row might mean a surfboard or kayak if one's available. The go step in open water is exponentially more dangerous than in a pool. If you're not a trained surf lifesaver, entering the ocean to rescue someone is extremely high risk. Even strong swimmers can get overwhelmed. The rip that caught the victim will catch you too.
The cold water factor? You mentioned the mammalian dive reflex being neuroprotective, but cold water also incapacitates the rescuer.
Cold water shock is immediate. The gasp reflex on sudden immersion can cause the rescuer to inhale water themselves. Then there's cold incapacitation. Within minutes, you lose dexterity and strength. Swimming becomes difficult, then impossible. So, a would-be rescuer who jumps into cold water is facing a double threat, the victim and the temperature. The guidelines for cold water rescue emphasize staying out of the water if at all possible. Call for professional help. Entering cold water is a last resort, and even then, it should ideally be done with a flotation device and a tether.
The tether is interesting. So you're tied to shore?
Or to a boat, or to another rescuer on land. The idea is that if you get into trouble, you can be pulled back. It's a standard technique in ice rescue. For the average person, the message is, do not enter cold water to rescue someone. Find another way.
That's a hard message to internalize, because the instinct to act is so powerful. Standing on shore watching someone drown while you wait for help, that's psychologically almost impossible.
And that's why the training has to override the instinct. You're not standing there doing nothing. You're reaching, you're throwing, you're calling emergency services, you're directing others, you're being the person who doesn't need rescuing. That's the reframe. Your job is to be the stable node in the rescue, not the second casualty. Because if you go in and drown, now there are two victims and zero rescuers, and the professional responders who arrive have a harder job.
The stable node. That's a good way to put it. Be the person who doesn't become the problem.
That principle extends to all the drowning scenarios we've talked about. Bathtub, pool, beach, bucket. The first question isn't, how do I save them? It's, how do I save them without needing to be saved myself? If the answer requires you to enter a situation you're not trained for, you find another answer.
What's the training threshold where go becomes a reasonable option? Because there's a spectrum between, I did a weekend course, and I'm a professional ocean lifeguard.
The honest answer is that the weekend course teaches you the basics of in-water rescue in a controlled environment, a pool with an instructor with a cooperative or semi-cooperative victim. It's enough for a backyard pool scenario where you can stand, where the distance is short, where the water is warm and calm. It is not enough for open water, cold water, or a panicking adult who outweighs you. Those scenarios require professional-level training and fitness. The Red Cross and similar organizations are explicit about this. The go step should only be attempted if you are a strong swimmer trained in water rescue. Not confident, not, I swam in high school.
There's a gap between what people think they can do and what they can actually do.
A lethal gap. And drowning statistics bear it out. The would-be rescuer drownings almost always involve someone who was a competent swimmer but had no rescue training. They underestimated the victim's panic response, or the cold, or the current, or their own endurance. Swimming ability is not rescue ability.
That's a line that should be on posters. Swimming ability is not rescue ability.
It should be. Because the mental model most people have is, I can swim, therefore I can help. And it's wrong in ways that get people killed.
Let's pivot to something Daniel didn't explicitly ask, but that I think is implied. What's changed in the past decade that a former lifeguard should know about? You've mentioned the rescue breath emphasis, the spinal precautions, the cold water resuscitation, the swim lessons for infants.
The AED guidance is worth highlighting. The current recommendation is that an AED should be used on a drowning victim as soon as possible, even if they've been in the water. The older concern was that a wet chest would cause arcing or ineffective shock delivery. The modern guidance is, dry the chest quickly, apply the pads, and follow the AED prompts. The shockable rhythms in drowning are less common than in primary cardiac arrest. Asystole is more typical, but if there is a shockable rhythm, early defibrillation improves outcomes. So you don't delay the AED.
Dry the chest and go. Not dry the entire person, not wait for towels.
Quick dry of the pad placement sites, then attach. Every minute without CPR and defibrillation reduces survival odds.
What about the recovery position? If someone's breathing after a drowning event, do you put them on their side?
Yes, if they're breathing and you don't suspect a spinal injury, the recovery position is recommended. It allows water or vomit to drain from the airway rather than being aspirated. If you do suspect a spinal injury, and that's the judgment call, you keep them as still as possible, maintain the head and neck in alignment, and monitor breathing continuously. If they stop breathing, the spinal percussion becomes secondary to ventilation. You roll them onto their back and start rescue breaths.
The hierarchy of priorities shifts with urgency. Spine matters until breathing stops, then breathing matters more.
That's the clinical logic. A person with a spinal injury who isn't breathing will die. A person with a spinal injury who is breathing can be stabilized and transported. So when the two conflict, airway and breathing take priority.
There's something about drowning that feels distinct from other first aid topics we've covered. The emotional weight of it. The fact that the rescuer is in danger. It's almost a perfect storm of everything that makes emergency response difficult.
And I think that's why the guidelines have become more prescriptive over time. They're trying to give people a script that works when their brain is flooded with panic. Reach, throw, row, go. 5 rescue breaths, then 30 and 2. Dry the chest. Apply the AED. Don't assume death in cold water. Get medical evaluation even if they seem fine. Each of those is a decision that's been made in advance, so you don't have to make it in the moment.
The pre-made decision. That's the core of all first aid training, really. You're not teaching people to improvise. You're teaching them to execute.
Drowning is where the cost of improvisation is highest. A burn, a cut, you can usually muddle through without making things dramatically worse. Drowning is binary. You either follow the sequence correctly, or someone dies.
For the person who's listening to this and thinking, I should probably know this stuff, what's the one thing they should do tomorrow?
If you have children, or if you spend time around water, take a CPR course that includes drowning-specific resuscitation. The American Heart Association and Red Cross both offer them. It's a few hours. And if you have a pool or live near open water, take a basic water rescue course. The skills are simple, but they're not intuitive. You need to practice them. The reach, throw, row, go sequence seems obvious in a classroom. It's less obvious when you're watching someone struggle.
For the person who was a lifeguard 10 years ago and assumes they still know what to do.
Take a refresher. The core principles haven't changed. The silence of drowning, the danger to the rescuer, the priority of breathing over compressions. But the details have shifted, and your skills have degraded. You're not the lifeguard you were. You're someone who used to be a lifeguard. There's a difference.
Someone who used to be a lifeguard. That's a humbling reframe for a lot of people.
It's meant to be. Humility around water is protective. Overconfidence is the thing that turns a rescue into a double drowning.
All right, I want to loop back to something we touched on earlier because I think it deserves more attention. The distracted supervision problem. You mentioned the National Drowning Prevention Alliance's Water Watcher campaign. What does that actually look like in practice?
The Water Watcher concept is simple. One designated adult whose only job for a set period, usually 15 to 20 minutes, is to watch the water. Not socializing, not on a phone, not reading, not drinking alcohol. At the end of the shift, you hand off to another adult who's been briefed. It's borrowed from lifeguarding, where rotations are standard specifically because vigilance degrades with time. The research on sustained attention says that even a motivated person's focus starts to slip after about 20 minutes, so you rotate.
The phone stays where?
In a bag, in the house, face down on a table out of reach. The water watcher doesn't have a phone in hand. Because the whole point is to eliminate the just checking one thing scenario. The text message can wait. The drowning cannot.
There's a cultural problem here, though. People feel rude not being reachable. Or they feel bored. The idea of just watching water for 20 minutes, no podcast, no music, no conversation, sounds almost monastic.
And the counter-argument is that watching water is not boring if you're actually watching. Lifeguards are trained to scan actively. Look at the surface, look at the bottom, look at the corners, look at the people who are quiet, count heads, recount heads. It's an active cognitive task, not passive staring. If you're bored, you're probably not actually scanning. You're zoning out.
The water watcher isn't just present. They're actively surveilling.
That's the standard, and it's a high bar. But the alternative is the scenario we described earlier. A child goes under silently while a parent checks Instagram 10 feet away. That's not a hypothetical. That's a recurring tragedy.
The phrase, present but not watching, is going to stick with me.
It's the gap that kills.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the high medieval period, a variant of kabaddi was played along the shores of Lake Tanganyika, where raiders were required to chant not words, but a continuous hum, and defenders won the round if they could make the raider laugh. making it possibly the only contact sport in history where the primary defensive strategy was comedy.
Right. Here's the thing I'm left with. Drowning is preventable. It's survivable with prompt and correct intervention, and the knowledge required to intervene correctly is not vast. It's a handful of principles and a sequence. And yet the numbers stay terrible. 236,000 a year.
Because the gap isn't knowledge. The gap is behavior. People know they shouldn't leave a toddler alone in the bath. They do it anyway. People know they should wash the pool, not their phone. They check the phone anyway. People know they shouldn't jump into cold water to rescue someone. They jump anyway. The guidelines are clear. The execution is where it falls apart.
The modern approach is essentially trying to engineer around human behavior rather than just informing it. Layers of protection, pre-made decisions, scripts for panic, designated water watchers with rotation schedules. It's an acknowledgement that knowledge alone doesn't work.
And that's what's changed most in the past decade. Not the physiology of drowning, that's the same. Not the rescue techniques, those are refined but fundamentally similar. It's the recognition that public health messaging has to account for how humans actually behave, not how we wish they'd behave. The distracted parent, the overconfident swimmer, the panicked bystander. The guidelines now assume those people exist and try to build guardrails around them.
Guardrails for human nature. That's the project.
It's an unfinished one. 236,000 deaths a year says we're not there yet.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping this ship afloat. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.